Good evening. I'm Gerald Duff, and I'm the Vice President of the College at Rhodes College, and as such, I take great pleasure in welcoming you to Rhodes and to the continuation of the inaugural series of the Lillian and Maury Moss Endowment for the Visual Arts. You, and I think most of Memphis by now, know of the overwhelming success of this program and of the enthusiasm with which it's been received in the community. It's a rare and wonderful gift indeed for us, not only for Rhodes College, but for the people of our city as well. Join me, please, in expressing our thanks to the man who's responsible for this, who makes it all possible, Mr. Maury Moss. In this first series focused on American art, architecture, and landscape, we turn tonight to a subject close to our roots and to a distinguished guest who is an authority on the art of the Old South, Dr. Jesse Pesch. Jesse Pesch is native of Iowa and a graduate of Antioch College in Ohio. She has an MA from the University of Delaware, where she was a fellow in the Winterthur Program in Early American Culture, and a PhD from the University of Pennsylvania in Art History. Since 1963, she has taught at Tulane's Newcomb College, where she is a professor of art history. Dr. Pesch's awards include grants from the American Philosophical Society and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Her articles have appeared in Antiques, Art Bulletin, and Country Life, among others. She has also published studies on Titian Ramsey Peale and early Louisiana furniture, and was one of the guest curators for the exhibition Painting in the South, organized by the Virginia Museum of Fine Arts, which was shown at five major museums in the South during 83-84. Jesse Pesch is widely known as the author of the well-received book, The Art of the Old South, Paintings, Architecture, and the Products of Craftsmen, 1560-1860, which was published in 1983. She is also recognized as curator for the exhibition Newcomb Pottery, an Enterprise for Southern Women, 1895-1940. Now on national tour under the auspices of the Smithsonian Institution Traveling Exhibition Services. She is also author of the catalog which accompanies this exhibition. Ladies and gentlemen, join me in welcoming Dr. Jesse Pesch.
Thank you, and I especially congratulate you for coming out on what seemed like a very stormy night, but I think it's not so bad now. I want to talk about painting in the South and themes in the painting of the South, mostly the period from 1800 to 1860. And I want to introduce this in at the end of the American Revolution. There was a Frenchman, the Marquis de Chasteloup, who had accompanied the French forces in America. And he wrote a letter in 1783 to the then president of the College of William and Mary on the progress of the arts and sciences in America. He was very interested in the new country and in the development of how it would develop and how a new democratic republic would develop. His idea of the role of art was that art should be instructive, that it should enlighten the mind, and so forth. And he hoped that the arts could flourish in America. There was something of hesitancy about this. I should say this letter was published in 1786. And Jefferson had access to it earlier. So it's the kind of ideas, it reflects the kind of ideas that philosophical people of that era were thinking about. He was concerned about how arts would flourish in the new democracy because he recognized that in the past, the fine arts had had their most brilliant periods under great patrons when there was a great inequality of wealth, such as under Augustus or under the powerful Roman popes. And he didn't know whether it would be possible for the arts to flourish in a rural country. And especially, he said, after he talked about this problem and the role of the arts, he said, there is one circumstance, however, which we have not yet touched upon and which seems indispensable both for the preservation and for their establishment. The arts, there can be no doubt about it, can never flourish except where a great number of men are assembled. They must have large cities. They must have capitals. America possesses five such which seem ready to receive them. You can name them yourself: Boston, New York, Philadelphia, Baltimore, and Charleston. But these are seaports, and commerce, it cannot be denied, has more magnificence than taste. It pays rather than encourages artists. Well, I'll start with the... Just to start with a map. This is a map not of 1800, but of the population distribution of 1830. And you can see why he was concerned, because it was indeed of still very rural country, and especially if we look at the South, even Charleston doesn't show up much as a very urban center, Baltimore a little bit, and then slightly denser population. Let's see, where are we? In the middle of Tennessee, indeed. But that in general, there was it was still a rural population, and the question was, can artists flourish in this kind of atmosphere? The founding of new capitals, new state capitals, were the kinds of communities, many of them which would have an educational institution as well, that the that were founded. For example, Richmond, the capital moved from Williamsburg to Richmond in 1780. In South Carolina, the capital moved from Charleston to Columbia. And in North Carolina, the capital moved to Raleigh in 1794. And they built a capitol building. Then a rather plain building. And then it wasn't until after the War of 1812, when there was a new surge of patriotism, that the state of South Carolina decided to, in fact, act as patrons and decided that they wanted a statue of George Washington to grace their Capitol building. And they consulted with Jefferson, and they decided the only artist who could handle this was the Italian sculptor Canova. So he was commissioned to create a sculpture of George Washington. And he Jefferson advised them also that the style of the costume, said Jefferson, "I'm sure that the artist and every person of taste in Europe would be for Roman. Our boots and regimentals have a very puny effect." So therefore, this was the statue that was created by Canova. It was destroyed in a fire in 1835, but this is a print that was made of it, and as you can see, the artist indeed showed him in this universal and timeless seeming costume of the Roman warrior rather than as we know him. It is interesting that Lafayette, when he came in 1825, said it was a very good likeness, which is very nice of him. But when the statue arrived in Raleigh in March of 1821, there was great pride and great fanfare, and the role of the arts as conceived by the person, Colonel William Polk, who gave the address. He was very proud of it and said that he hoped that North Carolina would set an example for the sister states, and that the record of such virtues should be transmitted to posterity by every means the muse of history, of painting, and of sculpture can employ. May we not, then, fellow citizens, indulge the hope that this beautiful specimen of the arts, besides its moral effects in holding up to the imitation of our youth the great qualities it commemorates, also refine their taste and awaken their latent energies of genius, that while it inculcates the virtues that render life useful to our country, it may diffuse a relish for the arts that embellish society and call forth a display of the varied powers of man's ingenuity. So that it was through this kind of patronage that the communities hoped to establish a tradition of the arts. This is at least the hope. In point of fact, it wasn't all that easy for artists to get commissions. Again, in North Carolina, however, to house this statue, they remodeled their state house, which had just been a plain brick building, and they added a dome, and they stuccoed it, and I think added a story or so. They apparently remodeled it a good bit. And this painting of the Capitol was done by an artist named Jacob Marling, who had come to Raleigh after 1813, and he did portraits and he did miniatures. He directed a small North Carolina museum. His wife taught painting and drawing at the Raleigh Academy, so that they contributed to the cultural life of this small new capital city. Then the North Carolina State Legislature also authorized the governor to purchase 2 full-length portraits of George Washington, and many state capitals, Kentucky, for example, and so forth, were commissioning copies of paintings of George Washington so that they would have these kind of, this sort of almost iconography of nationalism. This is how the statue was interpreted shortly after it had burned and was sort of recorded in memory. And I think it's very interesting that when it was recorded in memory, they put Gilbert Stuart's head on it so that it looked a little bit more like George Washington. Well, Thomas Sully then was commissioned. They decided on Sully to do these 2 paintings by George Washington, and one was a copy after Stuart, which he did and which still hangs in North Carolina. The other is very interesting because they didn't give Sully the dimensions of the space that they wanted, and Sully decided he would do what is called a large history painting, a painting which tells a story, but which is also morally uplifting and, again, has the kind of values, sort of teaching history, teaching the virtues through a painting. So Sully began this very large canvas, which is actually 12 feet, 2.5 inches by 17 feet, and he was working in Norfolk at the moment, showing, again, a kind of idealized Washington crossing the Delaware. Well, when it was finished, I think it's very probable that as soon as it was finished, Sully began to show it, in other words, to exhibit it in Virginia and Maryland, and that he probably had this in mind, that this he would use this to travel with it a bit, and then it would go to North Carolina. But then it turned out that it was too large, and so North Carolina didn't accept it. And I don't know what happened to it for a while. It ultimately ended up in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. And it is interesting that for many years it was rolled up in the basement of the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. But it is now, has been restored and is on show in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts. But it is an example of North Carolina patronage. And indeed, several of the southern states set an example for patronage. But it wasn't easy for artists, and there are some others. For example, the Charleston artist Thomas Coram succeeded in getting a commission to paint Christ blessing the children for the Charleston orphanage. But he didn't get many large commissions like that, and mostly he had to earn his living by engraving, by doing trade cards, by doing silver. And he also did small sketches, perhaps mostly for his own use. And this, we find a number of artists that are part of this cultural life of the South are people who were perhaps part-time painters and part-time something else, but who did indeed sometimes in their private sketchbooks. This is actually a very small sketch or oil. It's a small oil on paper, I think, showing the mulberry plantation near Charleston, and was done around 1800. But it is a nice intimate portrait of the mulberry plantation and the slave quarters that are a part of that. One finds other early visual images of the South recorded by Benjamin Henry Latrobe, who was the English-born architect who then came to America and who was indeed one of the first professional architects to work in this country. When he first came, he was in Virginia, and he was a marvelous draftsman. And these are from his sketchbook done around 1797 in Virginia. And this is, again, both a delightful sketch, watercolor, and also a very interesting document because it shows Green Spring Mansion, which is one of the, was then, no longer, a building which had been built, a home which had been built in 1646 and then added to. So it's one of our rare records of 17th century architecture in the South. Latrobe also was very interested in the land and the qualities of the land, and this is one of his sketches of the Dismal Swamp along the coast, along North Carolina. And also he does occasionally rather nice sketches. This is a scene in Maryland, which he did in 1798, of an overseer and his slaves. Through his private sketchbook, we see again that there are people with an interest in the arts. Another artist who started out as a lawyer in Charleston, but then became developed his skill as an artist, and after 1818, indeed earned his living as an artist. This is also from a small sketchbook that he did around 1803, and here we have the meeting house in South Carolina near Jacksonboro. The meeting house itself was built around 1728. It too is a rather unpretentious sketch, but it is also a very interesting document because it shows one of what were really quite a few dissenter meeting houses in South Carolina, and we tend, in the sort of oversimplification of the history of the North and the South, to think of Puritan meeting houses in the North and Anglican churches in the South, and it is a rather more complicated picture, and certainly these documents of meeting houses in South Carolina contribute to that. Another of his sketches that was done in, again, around 1803, 1805, was of Prince William's Parish Church in South Carolina, which had actually been burnt by the British in the Revolutionary War. But this little sketchbook, which is owned by the Gibbs Art Gallery in Charleston, has a whole group of very attractive sketches of landscape and buildings. Fraser then, as I said, after 1818, was able to earn his living as an artist, and he was primarily a painter of portrait miniatures, which are these very small paintings that people could keep hold in their hands, sometimes wear, put just sort of a private, almost private image, and they were very popular at this time. And Fraser... this is one he did in 1824 of a man named H.F. Plowden. And this is very small, and it magnifies beautifully. Fraser was extremely good at catching sort of very real qualities of the people. And also, it seems to me, he's particularly good with older people. He had a real kind of sense of catching their characters. When he was older, in 1857... there was a retrospective of his work held in Charleston, and this included 313 miniatures which he had painted and which represented the work of a 50-year life as an artist. Portraiture was very much the bread and butter of artists, and the ones who worked in the South had a variety of backgrounds, a variety of degrees of skill. And you can discern from this that this, again, is somebody who was not highly trained as an academic artist. And we find this in both North and South, that in the middle years of the 19th century, that there were a number of what one calls naive artists, which we in the 20th century can appreciate because we like something of that slightly stilted, slightly abstract quality almost. This artist is Jacob Freimeyer, who was painted around 1806. He had come from Lancaster County, Pennsylvania, and then he was essentially self-taught. He traveled then, and this was the case with many artists, and indeed it was true of artists who were located in New York, such as Samuel F.B. Morse, who spent part of every year for a while in Charleston. In no place, somehow, there still was not enough often for an artist to support himself completely by living in one place. Freimeyer traveled through Maryland, down the Valley of Virginia, and into Kentucky as the population was moving west. This is a painting of a Patricia Heals Collins, who was the wife of a wealthy landowner in Woodford County in central Kentucky. And even though he shows her in rather stark realism, there's also a feeling for the refinements of life, for lace and fine jewelry, and also for porcelain and hospitality. Another artist whose work is a little bit naive, a little bit hard-edged, the color areas are a little bit flat, is the work of Joshua Johnson, the research on him was primarily done by J. Hall Pleasance, who was one of the great scholars in Maryland. Joshua Johnson worked in and around Baltimore, and it has been identified as a free person of color and is probably the first identifiable black artist in this country. Here he shows Mrs. Thomas Everett and her children, and her husband, this was painted in 1818, her husband had died in 1817. So we see her as a widow in black and her children in black. And I do not know, but I think the two youngest children, therefore, were not confined to wearing black. So we have the little boy in the red and the little baby in white. Johnson there are several documents which help to identify him as a black artist and a free person of color. And one of those also is his advertisement in the Baltimore Intelligencer in December of 1798. And he advertised that he could do portrait paintings which would give precise and natural likenesses, and then added, "As a self-taught genius, deriving from nature and industry his knowledge of art, and having experienced many insurpassable obstacles in the pursuit of his studies, it is highly gratifying to him to make assurances of his ability to execute all commands with an effect and in a style which must give satisfaction." Now, another painting where, again, the artist is a little bit naive, and this is an artist perhaps quite familiar to many of you, is Ralph E.W. Earle, who had originally, he was the son of Ralph Earle, who was a Connecticut painter, and he had grown up partly in England when his father was there, and he had actually visited France. And then he came back to America in around 1815, and he too first began his career by traveling, and he traveled through Georgia, Alabama, Tennessee, and along the Mississippi. There are several basic routes which the different artists traveled in the South that have been traced by Mr. Pennington, who's the director of the Lauren Rogers Museum in Laurel, Mississippi. This is a painting of a Tennessee family, Mr. and Mrs. Ephraim Hubbard Foster and their children, done in 1824. And it shows the family as a close-knit family group. And it's very interesting the way each of the figures, I mean, the whole family is connected literally by gestures and so forth. So it gives you this feeling of a close-knit family. Foster himself had been in the army. He had served with Jackson in the Creole War of 1813-14, and he also was a color bearer in the Battle of New Orleans. But he chose to have himself depicted here more as a family man, a father, and a rather bourgeois image. And then the other perfectly charming thing is the little daughter, Jane Ellen, who is shown standing on the windowsill and in this really marvelous tartan mob cap that is very appealing. New Orleans was very much on the route of the itinerant artists as they came down the Mississippi Valley and then to New Orleans. And one of the artists who came there was Edmund Brewster, who had come to New Orleans to do a copy of Stuart's Washington for the city council. And again, one finds throughout various artists doing copies for city councils and state houses and so forth. But while there, he also painted a person who was a very dominant figure and a familiar figure in New Orleans culture, Père Antoine de Sedilla, who was a Capuchin monk who very much dominated religious affairs. He appears to be very stern. There are different stories about him, some of which show him to have been quite generous, and he was also fairly independent from the regular clergy. But you can see why New Orleans seemed like a very exotic and different city from some of the other cities. This is also what you call a grand portrait, a full-length portrait with attributes. You see him in his study with the book and so forth. And this is in the tradition of the sort of large paintings which, again, in a sense, point a moral by telling about a person, instructing about a person who is a leader in society. When Lafayette came to America in 1824-25, as you know, he was then the one of the few surviving officers of the American Revolution. He was a grand old man in his 70s, and he toured the entire United States at this time. And everywhere he went, he was received with great pleasure, and he behaved accordingly. You can practically make a tour of the most, what people thought was the most important architecture in the period by finding out where Lafayette stayed in any city. He was also painted, and there were commissions to have him painted. This is the painting that was done for the city of Richmond, Virginia, and it shows Lafayette. He wore a wig when he came back. If you know the paintings of him when he was a young man, he was sort of balding. But here, he may have posed for the head, and perhaps somebody else posed for the figure. But it's a little bit cut off, but it is another of the grand portraits. Paintings of Lafayette were done for the city of New York, for the capital of Kentucky, and for the city council of Charleston, for example. So his image was added to the sort of heroic icons of the new nation. The artist who had painted Lafayette was a French-born artist who had settled first in Santo Domingo and then in Virginia. And in the course of his career, he went several times back and forth to England and Europe and then came back to Richmond. Another artist who was a special kind of itinerant artist that seems mostly associated with New Orleans. In New Orleans, in the period of the 1830s particularly, there were a number of French artists who came every winter to New Orleans. They'd come about December and leave in March or April, and they would paint portraits. One of those was Jean-Joseph Vaudechamp. And this is, again, another of, not quite the full scale, but three-quarter length portrait of Antoine-Jacques-Philippe de Marigny de Mandeville, who was one of New Orleans' aristocrats, if you will. He was in the military. He was a lieutenant or a captain in the first squadron of cavalry in New Orleans. Another painting, and Vaudechamp represents, he exhibited in the Salon in Paris several years, and he represents the very tight, precise combination of realism and neoclassicism of the French academic painting of that time. Another of the paintings that he did at this period is a Madame Antonio Ruzzat, done in 1839. She was a young matron. This is paired with a painting of her husband, which was done in France. But here again you have this realism, and also there I will show you later one painting I know of, quote, a Southern Belle. But there are not as many as our sort of imagined history would make us think. The painting of a Southern Belle was not necessarily done frequently. And here, this attractive young matron, nonetheless, is done with great honesty, and so there is no desire to kind of glorify her or make her more romantic-looking than she was. And indeed, if we look at some other paintings of young women, these are a painting of two sisters, Henrietta and Sarah Mayo, painted by William Hubbard, who worked in Richmond, painted in 1838-1840, and they were the daughters of a very wealthy Richmond family, or reasonably well-to-do, certainly. But here again, there is no desire to idealize or to romanticize, and this, I find, actually, this pair of portraits really very moving, almost melancholy in their kind of very sensitive feeling for these young women. And again, as one looks at other portraits, and portraits were very popular in this period, both in the South and indeed also in the North. This is another painting by Vaudechamp of a young widow, Céline Charbonnet, painted in 1839. And one has, if you go, there have been several publications by the Colonial Dames on portraits. Their interest has been more genealogical than art historical, but nonetheless, what is very interesting to go through these volumes and see the number of portraits which are of bourgeois, rather plain, straightforward, realistic portraits. You don't have pages and pages of great, sort of elaborate, grand paintings of, quote, Southern aristocrats. Here you can sense really quite a young woman, but who is in mourning. Either she was, I think, a widow, but people wore mourning, as you know, for many members of the family, so that often with the high incidence of mortality and so forth, you have people wearing mourning a good bit of the time. Another of the paintings by Vaudechamp, also of a widow, Madame Theodore Bailey Blanchard, painted in 1832. She is, again, wonderfully realistic and also bears her widowhood well, I think one can say. But it's a very engaging but also very realistic portrait. And it's no surprise, if you look at portraits of this period and the interest in realism, that this is indeed the period when photography was discovered. And so it's a combination almost of the people's need for this kind of thing as well as developing the technical ability. William Dunlap, who is one of the first historians of American painting and was kept a diary and later wrote a kind of history of American painting, in his diary in New York in May 1st, 1834, he wrote about Vaudechamp and said that Vaudechamp is going home. He made $30,000. He's a painter and a gentleman and made his fortune in 3 years. Another portrait, this is done by in 1827 by another self-taught artist, Patrick Davenport of Danville, Kentucky, and it is of Mrs. Isaac Shelby, who was the widow of the governor of Kentucky. This was done when she was 63 years old. She had recently been widowed. She had had 11 children and had raised them in Lincoln County, Kentucky. And again, there is not a desire. This is somebody of some status in the community. But again, it is a very straightforward, and again, in this case, slightly naive, rather hard-edged painting. In the paintings of this period, there are not many, but there are some paintings of free people of color. And here, too, they are portraits of bourgeois images, really. This is attributed to François Fleischbein, who was a painter from Alsace-Lorraine, who came and then lived for the rest of his life in New Orleans, of a young free woman of color. And again, by her dress and her manner, she is in this uncomfortable stage that free people of color were between the free whites and between the slaves. Nonetheless, a person of bourgeois status. There were people, there were musicians, there were small landowners, there were craftsmen, and so forth, who were free people of color, and one does have some record of them in the paintings. This is of James Armistead Lafayette, another free man of color, who was painted in Virginia by the artist John Martin, who had come to the United States from Ireland, painted in 1824 when Lafayette visited Virginia. And he had been Lafayette's scout during the American Revolution, and Lafayette had freed him. And so at the same time that Lafayette was painted, his former scout, who was, again, a kind of bourgeois person, was painted as well. One has also in the portraits paintings of the multi-race quality of the South, a number of portraits of Indians. One of the most famous Indians of this period, famous for tragic reasons, was Osceola, who was a Seminole Indian, who in the war with the Seminoles was lured into, invited to surrender and came out with a white flag, and then was captured and put in Fort Moultrie in Charleston, South Carolina. And it was something of a cause célèbre, and many people objected to what had happened. He was apparently a very dignified, handsome Indian, and he was painted by several people. This painting was done by Robert Curtis, who was a German-born artist who'd grown up in Charleston, and it was painted in this case for a patron of his who commissioned him to paint it, a man named Dr. Baker, who also paid for Curtis a little later to go to Europe and to study. But it is a very compassionate portrait of Osceola, who in fact died in the prison within the year. We think of George Catlin primarily as a painter of the Indians of the American West, but in his survey of Indians, he indeed spent time in Florida and painted several members of the Seminole Indians, and then he also visited Fort Moultrie, where a number of the Seminole Indians were being kept. And this is his painting of one of the Indian chiefs that was called Philip of the Seminole Indians. So we also have a record of the Indians of the American South and of the so-called Five Nations. This is a painting of a Cherokee squaw done by the artist Edward Troy in 1836. And I will come back to some of the other work of Troy, but here Troy very, very seldom did portraits of ordinary white people. But he did occasionally do portraits such as this and a few members of his family. Another kind of portrait that was part of the artist's bread and butter, which were not particularly easy commissions, were posthumous portraits. And this was true, again, in both the North and the South. And this is a very attractive, small miniature, about that big, painted by the artist John Wood Dodge in Nashville in 1846. And the subject is the little boy, Felix Grundy Aikens. And we see him, you can read the imagery and recognize that it's a posthumous portrait. You have the urn, the withered flower, the broken toy, the tool laid down. And Dodge kept an account book. And in his account book, he usually charged $75 to $100. And for this, he charged $225. This is both slightly larger, has more imagery than most, and also, as he recorded it, it was taken after death. And again, it's a very moving image, which is now in the Cheekwood collection. So that there's a whole range of portraiture that was done, and which also indirectly gives us some image of the people of the South at this time. Dodge is interesting. He too traveled. He came down to New Orleans. He traveled through Alabama, through Virginia, through Tennessee, Mississippi, and Louisiana. And then I think I'm correct that he settled in Cumberland County, and he later became famous for raising Pomona apples and is the person responsible for popularizing them. Landscape developed the development of the interest in landscape painting, first of all, in America, developed rather slowly, and in fact, one can almost say that of England in the 18th century. It isn't more until the 19th century that you have another big development of landscape painting. In the South, the South's answer to Niagara was the Natural Bridge in Virginia as a kind of phenomena to be observed. And indeed, Chastellux had employed an engraver to make a record of it, and that's one of our first visual images of it. This was painted in 1835 by an artist named John Ward. It is interesting also, I think some of you may know, that Jefferson owned the property the land on which the Natural Bridge was, and he did allow the public to come see the Natural Bridge. He saw it as one of the phenomena of the New World, and certainly he helped to, therefore, protect it for some time. It was a place to visit, and two ministers visited it in 1834-1835, and they described in their diary how they saw the bridge springing from this bed of verdant loveliness, distant, complete. He went on to say that that the bridge, it is sublime, so strong, and yet so elegant, springing from earth and bathing its head in heaven. Then, but it is sublime not allied to the terrifying, as at Niagara. It is the sublime associated with the pleasing. I sat and gazed in wonder and astonishment. That afternoon was the shortest I ever remembered. So that it was a phenomena to be observed and so forth. And this artist does catch something of this sort of extraordinary natural masonry of the bridge.